Well, turn with me, please, to the passage we read earlier on, 2 Kings chapter 20. And we'll be looking really at verses 12 to 19 as we come this morning to our fourth and final study in the reign of Hezekiah. Now, if you can remember our previous three studies at all, you might well have got the impression from them that Hezekiah was practically flawless. In our first study, we thought about his superiority to virtually all the other kings of Judah, Josiah being the only other one who excelled to a remotely similar degree. And we thought also that morning about the far-reaching reformation which Hezekiah initiated and which he presided over throughout the land of Judah. Then in our second study, we considered Hezekiah's impressive resilience in the face of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, as this notorious, formidable, pagan ruler poured out his threats on Jerusalem, and as he gratuitously belittled Judah's God. Hezekiah, you remember, refused to crumble. He refused to buckle. He kept on believing. He kept on trusting. He kept on looking to God for deliverance. Then in our third session, we thought about Hezekiah's illness and the way in which when Hezekiah was suddenly struck by this devastating personal crisis, this boil, this terminal illness, what did he do? He instinctively prayed to God. He instinctively took his tears to the throne of grace. He instinctively sought the aid of his Father in heaven. And so, as I say, you might well have got the impression that this man could basically do nothing wrong. Well, I'm afraid that this morning's passage dispels all such notions. You could only conclude that Hezekiah was a flawless individual by ignoring altogether the data of 2 Kings chapter 12, verses 12 to 19. But having said that, I don't think we should go to the other extreme and exaggerate the shortcomings which are revealed by this passage in Hezekiah's character and in Hezekiah's life. Some of the commentators, I think, leave this passage with a much more negative view of Hezekiah than is warranted. It seems to me that Hezekiah was, in the last analysis, a truly remarkable person. And we ought to leave his life with an overwhelmingly positive assessment of him. He was one of the great saints, I think, of the Old Testament. And so, as I say, I don't think that we should exaggerate the shortcomings that this passage exposes. This passage isn't saying that Hezekiah was a terrible man. It isn't inviting us to shake our heads with disgust at Hezekiah. It isn't inviting us to look down our noses with disdain at Hezekiah. What it is doing, however, is saying that even Hezekiah wasn't perfect. That in common with every other child of Adam, there was sin and there was failure and there was inconsistency in the life and in the character of King Hezekiah. So I want us to look at this passage this morning then, and I want to do so in terms of two visits. First of all, the visit of Babylon's messengers, and then secondly, the visit of God's messenger. First of all then, the visit of Babylon's messengers. So we read in verse 12 that at that time, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah letters and a gift, because he had heard of Hezekiah's illness. So the king of Babylon then has received news that Hezekiah has been unwell, and in all probability, although it's not mentioned explicitly, he had received news of Hezekiah's miraculous recovery as well. And having received this news, he responds by sending Hezekiah a message. Probably this message expressed his sympathy for the traumatic experience that Hezekiah had passed through, And doubtless it also expressed his joy and his delight at the restoration to health, which Hezekiah had also experienced. And so, on the face of things, that's what's going on here. The king of Babylon is responding to this personal crisis which Hezekiah has gone through, and is responding in a very warm and friendly manner. He's sending a message and he's sending a gift to him. But you don't have to be the world's greatest cynic to smell a rat here. If you know anything at all of the politics of the ancient Near East, you'll know that those politics were generally marked by out-and-out ruthlessness and by naked nationalistic ambition. Heads of states in the ancient Near East did not normally sit around in their offices writing gentlemanly letters to one another. And when, therefore, we're presented with this spectacle here of the king of Babylon sending this sweet, endearing message to the king of Judah, you can't help suspecting that there's something fishy going on. You can't help suspecting that there's some kind of ulterior motive at work, that there's some kind of hidden agenda being pursued. I don't suppose the king of Babylon was remotely interested in Hezekiah's boil, really. I don't suppose he could care less, really, that Hezekiah had had some kind of extraordinary deliverance through figs being applied to it. I don't suppose he could care less about the shadow of the sun having retreated those 10 steps down the stairway of Ahaz. I don't suppose he was remotely interested in these things. What he probably was interested in, however, was a political alliance with Judah. You see, Babylon was at this point an up-and-coming empire. It had very great ambitions. It desperately wanted to assert itself as a major rival to the great superpower of the day, Assyria, headed by King Sennacherib, as we've seen in previous weeks. And although an alliance with a little state like Judah wasn't really going to make all that much difference in the grand scheme of things, still, every little helps. And it's almost certain that that is what the king of Babylon would have had his eye on here. The whole business of Hezekiah's illness and recovery, that was just a convenient pretext. What he really wanted here was some kind of political alliance with Judah. And he would have been pretty confident, I'm sure, of securing one. For one thing, he would have imagined Hezekiah to be this utterly petrified little king, terrified of the threat of Assyria, terrified of what Sennacherib was going to do to Judah, and desperate, therefore, to get into an alliance with any other nation. And for another thing, he would have imagined Hezekiah to be deeply honored to be invited into an alliance with Babylon of all nations, because Babylon was such an eminent and such a prestigious nation. And he would have expected, therefore, Hezekiah to jump at the chance of an alliance with Babylon. He would have expected Hezekiah to welcome this with open arms. But, you see, the king of Babylon didn't know Hezekiah. And he didn't know that Hezekiah wasn't the kind of king to jump into alliances with other nations. That Hezekiah wasn't really all that interested in political deals and political treaties, because Hezekiah was an ardent believer in his God. And Hezekiah was utterly persuaded that his God would deliver Judah from all her enemies, and that he didn't need, therefore, political expedients. He didn't need to strike treaties. He didn't need to be going around sucking up to all the other nations, because he had a God who had entered into a covenant with that nation, and he was trusting in him. And as far as we can tell then, this treaty never came about. There's no evidence either in this passage or anywhere else in the Old Testament that an alliance was formed between Judah and Babylon here. So we know from other passages, as we've said before, that there were some in Judah certainly who were wanting to lean a bit too heavily on Egypt. But there's no evidence whatsoever that this visit of these Babylonian delegates resulted in a treaty being formed between Judah and Babylon. It seems as though these visitors went back empty-handed to their king, who doubtless was most frustrated by what had happened. And you're probably thinking then that surely what we have here in 2 Kings 20, verses 12 to 19, is yet another example of what a wonderful King Hezekiah was. Just another example of how outstanding and exemplary his faith in God was, that he refused to enter into this treaty with Babylon. And you're probably thinking then, what on earth was my introduction all about? Why was I saying that this passage dispels all notions that Hezekiah was a flawless man? Surely it only confirms the notion that Hezekiah was, in fact, a flawless and faultless and sinless ruler of Judah. Well, you see, this is the point. In the face of these Babylonian visitors, Hezekiah's faith, his trust, his confidence in God did indeed shine. He didn't enter into this treaty with Babylon. But in the face of these Babylonian visitors, Hezekiah's humility did not shine. He just couldn't resist the temptation to take these guys on a grand tour of all his treasures and of all his storehouses. Verse 13, Hezekiah received the messengers and showed them all that was in his storehouses, the silver, the gold, the spices, and the fine oil, his armory, and everything found among his treasures. There was nothing in his palace or in all his kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. And so do you see what's going on here? These Babylonian visitors come to Jerusalem, and Hezekiah successfully avoids the obvious danger that they presented. He doesn't get drawn into any kind of political alliance. But Hezekiah is ensnared by a much less obvious danger that they presented. He gets carried away, gloating to them and showing off to them vainly about all his goods and all his treasures. You know, I don't think that's a phenomenon that was unique to King Hezekiah. I think that's probably a fairly common pattern in the experience of believers. I think probably that this is often the experience of the Christian believer. So that there's some new development, you see, in the believer's life. And this new development in the believer's life carries with it one particular very obvious danger, perhaps. And it also carries with it a whole load of other much less obvious dangers. And the believer successfully avoids the obvious danger, doesn't get caught up in that, but is ensnared by one of the other less obvious dangers. So, you see, it might be the young Christian in the office who has to work closely for a period alongside the ardent, long-standing Jehovah's Witness. And the obvious danger is that the Jehovah's Witness will take advantage of the young Christian's spiritual immaturity and will turn that young Christian into a Jehovah's Witness. That doesn't happen. What does happen, however, is that the two of them have an affair. Or it might be the Christian businessman who suddenly, out of the blue, is made redundant. And the obvious danger for him is that he gets consumed by anxiety and by worry. How am I going to maintain this lifestyle to which I've been accustomed? How am I going to get another job? What am I going to do to continue in work? That doesn't happen. What does happen, however, is that he slips into laziness and slothfulness. He loses all interest in finding another job. He just sits around all day and grasps at any benefits that the government are offering him. Or it might be the Christian family that decides to purchase a television for the first time. And the obvious danger is that they'll become addicted to the thing, that they'll just sit there and watch television the whole day and will become obsessed with it. That doesn't happen. What does happen, however, is that they're a bit strapped for cash, and so they decide to to go for as long as they can without paying the TV license fee. Now, those might be rather silly and contrived examples, but you take my point that so often it's not the obvious danger in a certain temptation that gets us. So often it's one of the less obvious dangers that gets us. And this means, you see, that as Christians we need to be terribly, terribly wise. And we need to be terribly, terribly vigilant. We must never view temptation in simplistic, one-dimensional terms. You see, it's no use, for instance, deciding that it's quite okay for you to go out every weekend to nightclubs on the basis that you're strong enough not to get drunk and not to take drugs. That might be the case. You might indeed be strong enough not to do those things. But what about the scantily clad women who will also be patronizing the nightclub? Are you strong enough to cope with that? Similarly, it's no use you deciding that it's okay for you to go around the country following your football club simply on the basis that you're strong enough not to get drawn into the obscene language and the racist sentiments that fly around the terraces. Now, that may be the case. You may be strong enough not to get drawn into that stuff. But what about the temptation for your football club to become your idol, to become more important to you than anything else in your life? Are you strong enough to cope with that? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm saying that temptation is never one-dimensional. It's much more complex. It's much more subtle. And that's because, of course, the one behind it, the tempter, Satan, the devil, he is subtle and he is complex. And that was Hezekiah's experience here. The obvious danger was for Hezekiah just to go with the flow, get into a political alliance, trust Babylon's military might rather than God's covenantal promises. He didn't fall for that, but he fell for something else. He fell for pride. Look, you Babylonians, come and look at all I possess. The temptation was subtle. It was complex. It had more than one prong to it. And temptation always will, as long as we live in this world in which the tempter operates, in which temptation is so rife. It will always be complex. It will always be subtle. And you and I must be on our guard. We must be vigilant. We must be wise that we don't go the same way as Hezekiah did here. So that's the first thing, the visit of Babylon's messengers. But secondly, this morning, the visit of God's messenger. Because in verse 14 then, the Babylonian guys presumably having gone back now, Isaiah the prophet comes to visit Hezekiah. And we're told in some detail in verses 14 and 15 the conversation that ensued between these two men. Isaiah asks him, what did those men say and where did they come from? From a distant land, Hezekiah replied. They came from Babylon. The prophet asked, what did they see in your palace? They saw everything in my palace, Hezekiah said. There is nothing among my treasures that I did not show them. It's amazing, isn't it, how Hezekiah here seems to be utterly oblivious to the fact that he has done anything wrong. He betrays no sign at all here of shame, no sign at all here of embarrassment. He's happy to say to Isaiah quite openly, there is nothing among my treasures that I did not show them. You'd have thought he'd have been a bit embarrassed and he'd have been playing it all down. Oh, well, Isaiah, they maybe saw one or two of my storehouses. I showed them one or two of my ornaments, but, you know, that was it. But no, he's quite open. Isaiah, I showed them everything. He doesn't appear to have any sense at all that he has acted amiss. He reminds me a little bit of one of his forefathers, King David. Do you remember how on one occasion Nathan the prophet came to visit David? And Nathan told David a little story. It was a story about this rich man who, even though he possessed innumerable animals of his own, went down the road, you remember, to his poor neighbor and took from his poor neighbor his one little ewe lamb. And he killed that and he ate that instead of taking any of his vast numbers of animals. And remember how David hears this story and he's incensed. Who is this man, he says to Nathan? He should die. You know, there's no sense at all in David that the story was aimed at him. Because, of course, he was someone who had loads of wives of his own, loads of women in his palace, and yet he had gone to poor Uriah the Hittite, and he had taken his one wife, Bathsheba, and he had slept with her. And Nathan has to spell it out to him in great detail. You're the man, David. You're the one I'm talking about. You're the one who has committed this sin. And it's no surprise, I think, that it's David, therefore, that same man who pens Psalm 19. You remember how in verse 12 of that psalm, he says there, doesn't he? Who can discern his errors? Forgive my hidden faults. I don't think he ever forgot, after that visit from Nathan, the terrible potential that there is in the believer for massive hidden faults, that one can be sinning, and sinning really pretty badly, and yet it just never strikes you that you're sinning at all. And I think that we have that kind of scenario here with Hezekiah, not to the same extent, but here, again, Hezekiah is, he has a hidden fault in his life. He has welcomed these Babylonian visitors. He has shown them all his treasures. He's gloated to them. He has been puffed up vainly because of these people. And yet, he doesn't seem to be aware that he's done anything wrong at all. And it's a word of warning to us all, isn't it? That potential is there for all of us. Hidden sins. Sins that it never even strikes us they're sins. Hannah and I often talk about the different blind spots that we have when we're washing up. When I'm washing up, I have my certain blind spots. There's certain things. It's always the same things that I never actually bother to wash up. And when Hannah's washing up, in my opinion anyway, there's certain things that she never does either. She has her blind spots. And we all have blind spots in all kinds of areas. And we can have blind spots in this area when it comes to sin. We can have blind spots. It may be the case sometimes that some of the worst sins in our lives are in those thoughts and in those words and in those deeds about which we are most unconcerned and about which we are most blasé. We'll never think of confessing sins in those particular areas. That was Hezekiah's experience here. But you might be thinking, what really was wrong anyway with what Hezekiah did? Are we not making a bit too much here of what happened when those Babylonian visitors came to Hezekiah? Yes, all right, he showed them round all his riches and treasures. And yes, that may suggest a certain pride, it may suggest a certain sense of self-importance that was rather inappropriate. But still, at the end of the day, wasn't it really harmless enough what he was doing? Well, I think that that question is answered in verses 16 to 18, because in verses 16 to 18, the word of the Lord now comes to Isaiah. Isaiah has come, he's had this little conversation with Hezekiah, but now he's the prophet of God, of course, and the word of the Lord comes through him. It's very interesting, actually, isn't it? How the message of God, which comes through Hezekiah, comes through Isaiah to Hezekiah here, is so different to the message of God that had come through Isaiah to Hezekiah just a bit earlier on in the chapter. Remember in verses 4 to 6, that was the last time that Isaiah had spoken God's word to Hezekiah. And there it was such a comforting message, wasn't it? There it was such a reassuring message that you're not going to die after all. God has heard your prayer. He's seen your tears. He's going to give you an extra 15 years of life. It was such a wonderfully comforting message. And yet here now, we're just a few verses further on. And again, the word of the Lord comes to Hezekiah through Isaiah. And this time it's got a very different tone to it. This time it's a rather uncomfortable, solemn message. And still, you know, the word of God speaks to us in different ways. Yes, of course, there's much in the word that is comforting. Much that is reassuring. Much that is full of hope. Much that is good news. But we must never think that the Bible is simply a repository of nice little sayings to comfort us when we're feeling a bit down. The kind of verses that inevitably and invariably appear on Christian calendars. because sometimes the Word of God speaks to us uncomfortably. Sometimes it disturbs us. Sometimes it's dislodging us from a certain place where we are and where we shouldn't be. And we must never, therefore, avoid the harder parts of the Bible. We should never try and sweep under the carpet the bits that are a bit more uncomfortable to read. We must take it all, whether it's the kind of message that Hezekiah was receiving in verses 4 to 6, or whether it's the kind of message that he's receiving now in verses 16 to 18. But anyway, as the word of the Lord comes to Hezekiah then, through Isaiah, I think it exposes precisely what was wrong with what Hezekiah had done. The Lord, through Isaiah here, puts his finger on what it was that was wrong with receiving these Babylonians and showing them round his treasures. Two things. First of all, Hezekiah was valuing the wrong thing. He was valuing the wrong thing. Look at verse 16. Hear the word of the Lord. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your fathers have stored up until this day will be carried off. In other words, the Lord is saying to Hezekiah, look, you're attaching all this importance to these riches and treasures, which at the end of the day are so ephemeral. They're so transient. They're so fleeting. They're so impermanent. In only a generation or two's time, they're going to be carried off. They're going to be gone. Here you are going around saying, look, you Babylonians, this pile of gold, that's mine. And look at these weapons here, those are mine. And look at this, that's mine. Look at this, that's mine. And the Lord is saying, look, they're only yours in the most limited sense. They're only yours for a very short time. Before long, they're just going to be carried away. They're going to be housed in the palace of another kingdom altogether. They're going to be the showcase of another king, even in another kingdom, another part of the world. It's ridiculous placing so much value on things that are so ephemeral and so fleeting. That's what we were singing about in Psalm 49 there, isn't it? The folly of getting all obsessed with wealth when we leave that wealth to others. And that's what the Lord is saying to Hezekiah here. All this wealth that you've been showing these Babylonians with such pride in your heart, it's ridiculous. You're going to leave it to others. And it's something that you and I must never forget. It's a very solemn truth, isn't it? I think of the house where Hannah and I are living now, and the previous owner for 40 years or whatever, he just worked so tirelessly on the garden. He was obsessed with it, he loved it, and he was constantly doing things with this garden, it seems. And yet here now, Hannah and I have been in the house for just over a year, and in some cases by accident, in some cases by design, we've undone probably about 70 or 80% of all his wonderful work in that garden. And what was it all about? It's just left to others. He has it no more. He has no more influence there, no more contribution to make to it. And the same will happen to us. We'll decorate the house in the way that we want it to be. We'll do this to it, we'll do that to it. And then it'll be passed on to someone else eventually. And that's the way, isn't it? That's the way with earthly wealth and earthly possessions. Yes, they're ours, but only in the most limited sense. Only in the most provisional sense. Only in the most temporary sense. Only in the most fleeting sense. And let's not make Hezekiah's mistake, therefore, of valuing too highly things that are going to be carried off, that are going to be left to others. So he's valuing the wrong thing. But secondly, he's seeking the wrong praise. Because you see, there's a deliberate irony here. That the Lord is saying, the time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your fathers have stored up until this day will be carried off. Carried off where? To Babylon. And then he continues in verse 18, and some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood that will be born to you, will be taken away. They will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So these people, this nation that you've been sucking up to so much, Hezekiah, that you've been wanting to gain such admiration from, you've been wanting to gain their applause and their compliments. Do you realize, the Lord is saying, what kind of a nation Babylon is? It's the most bloodthirsty and ruthless nation. Before long, it's going to come and invade Judah. It's going to carry off all Judah's inhabitants. It's even going to make eunuchs of your own flesh and blood. That's not the kind of nation that you want to be sucking up to. That's not the kind of nation whose applause you want to be seeking. It's the most corrupt and disgusting and violent and contemptible nation. What are you doing making so much effort to win their praise? And again, isn't that pertinent to ourselves? We're surrounded by people in our workplaces, for instance, colleagues, some of whom are very immoral, perhaps. Some of whom live lives of promiscuous sexuality. Others who often are drunkards. They live outwardly immoral lives. Then there are others who don't, who live outwardly respectable and decent lives. But even they have such meaningless lives. Their lives are so empty, they're so vacuous, they're so aimless. And yet so often, it's these kinds of people, whether the out-and-out immoral or those who simply have empty, meaningless lives. It's their praise, isn't it, that we're trying to win? So often it's their applause that we value more than anything. So often it's their compliments and their commendation that means so much to us. And the Lord is saying to Hezekiah, that's ridiculous. Don't go out for the praise of Babylon. And, of course, although it's not said here, we know from the rest of the Bible that it's the praise of God himself that we should set our affections on. Jesus said to the Jews at the end of John 5, verse 44, I think, that you accept praise from one another, but you make no effort to obtain the praise of the only God. Let's make sure that we're not seeking the wrong praise, the praise of those whose praise means nothing, but that we're seeking the praise of the only God whose praise means everything. But then, finally, in verse 19, Hezekiah responds, doesn't he, to the word of the Lord. Isaiah, as we said, he's come and visited Hezekiah. He's engaged him in this preliminary conversation. Then the word of the Lord has come directly through him to Hezekiah. And now, finally, in verse 19, Hezekiah responds to it. And I mentioned in my introduction that Hezekiah often is treated quite harshly by some of the commentators here in this passage. And I suppose I'm particularly thinking of this verse here because he tends to come out of this in a very bad light in many of the commentaries. But I think that that is probably quite unfair. I think that this idea that Hezekiah in verse 19 is speaking selfishly and is self-absorbed, which is the idea, as I say, that is often that is often passed around. I think that that rests on misunderstandings. That's what is often said, isn't it, about verse 19, that when he says, the word of the Lord you have spoken is good, will there not be peace and security in my lifetime? He's basically saying, oh, at least all this isn't going to happen to me. And so he can't see beyond his own life. He's just utterly self-absorbed. But I think, as I say, that rests on certain misunderstandings, too, in particular. For one thing, it's often thought, I think, that Hezekiah here is being told that he deserves this judgment from God. He and Judah at that particular time deserve this judgment from God because of what he's just done by showing these Babylonians around his storehouses. He deserves this judgment from God, but God in his mercy is going to suspend it and deliver it to his descendants instead. But that's not the case. In verses 16 to 18, the Lord isn't saying that you deserve this judgment. He isn't saying, look, Hezekiah, I'm just a hair's breadth here from pouring out my judgment on you, but I'm going to suspend it and I'm going to pour it out on your descendants instead. There's no suggestion that Hezekiah was the one who should have been receiving this judgment. I think the only reason that there in verses 16 to 18, God mentions what's going to happen a few generations down the line is because of what we've just been saying, this connection with Babylon, the irony of Hezekiah sucking up to Babylon when Babylon was going to be the one who would take them off into exile a bit further down the line. So I don't think it's the case that Hezekiah is celebrating the fact here that the judgment he is being spared is going to come to his descendants instead. That is not the case. And the other misunderstanding is the meaning of those words peace and security in verse 19. That often they're taken as simply national peace, national security. That throughout my lifetime, that things are going to be easy and we're not going to be invaded by foreign armies. But I don't think that's the case. These two words in the Hebrew are very significant, loaded, theological words. The word peace, it's that word shalom. And generally, when that's used in the Old Testament, it has the meaning of much more than a mere national peace. It's talking about a vertical peace, peace with God. It's talking about Him shining His face upon you. It's talking about God's goodwill, God being favorably disposed toward you. And then this word security, which I think is a disastrous translation, it's again a very significant Old Testament word. It's, I think the New King James translates it truth, which is closer. It's faithfulness, really. Covenant faithfulness. And it's talking, again, they're not about some national thing. It's talking about a vertical thing. God's covenant faithfulness, His faithfulness to His promises to look after Judah and do His people good. And so, when you realize that then, I think that two things come out of it with which I close. First of all, I think Hezekiah is to be commended here in verse 19. Because I think what we're seeing here is him now suddenly valuing the right things again. Remember I said a moment ago he was valuing the wrong things for a period. He was valuing his treasures, his earthly treasures. But now I think the very last thing we're being told about him before the writer finishes the story of Hezekiah is that he's valuing the right things again. What matters to him now is God's shalom, God's peace, and God's faithfulness. Those are the things that are important to him now. He ends up rejoicing that throughout his lifetime, that they're going to experience the peace of God. God smiling upon them, and the faithfulness of God. God keeping all his promises to protect and deliver and look after his people. Those things matter to him. And so I think that Hezekiah is right in what he says here. I think he's being commendable in what he says. And it challenges us this morning. I said earlier, make sure you're not valuing the wrong thing. Well, are you valuing the right thing? Is peace with God and God's faithfulness to his promises, is that more important to you than anything? Is that more important to you than your bank balance, than your salary, than your inheritance? God's peace, that unshakable, undisturbable peace with God. Does that thrill you when you wake up in the morning much more than anything else ever could? And God's faithfulness, that he'll never break his promises to his people. Does that thrill you? Does that move you? Does that encourage you more than anything else when you wake up in the morning? So that's the first thing, Hezekiah is to be commended. But secondly, there's something poignant here, I think. Because he says, doesn't he, will there not be peace and faithfulness, God's peace and God's faithfulness in my lifetime? You see, Hezekiah was going to die. And yes, there was going to be peace and faithfulness throughout his life. But he could guarantee it no longer than that. And I think we're being reminded here, just in those last three words, in my lifetime, that Hezekiah was an outstanding king, as we've said so many times. He was an outstanding son of David, but he wasn't the son of David. He wasn't the king who was going to come. He wasn't Jesus. Because this king, yes, he could guarantee for his subjects God's peace and God's faithfulness for his lifetime. but not beyond that. He was going to die, and beyond that, the future was uncertain. But you see, a greater king was going to come along. Hezekiah's greater son, David, son Jesus, he was going to come along. And he was going to be a king who would secure for his people God's peace and God's faithfulness. Yes, again, during his lifetime. But his life was never going to end. He was never going to go down to the grave. Jesus was going to live forever. And he still is today living forever. He's alive at the right hand of God. And still, therefore, God's peace and God's faithfulness are guaranteed to us. Because Jesus, our King, is still living. The people of Judah, once Hezekiah had gone into the grave, they were no longer guaranteed God's peace and God's faithfulness. But we, because our King is alive forevermore in the power of an indestructible life, the New Testament says, we are guaranteed forever and ever the peace of God, his smile upon us, and his faithfulness, keeping all his promises. Do you know that this morning? Are you a believer in King Jesus? Are you his subject? Are you under his rule? It would have been wonderful to have Hezekiah as your king, but it's infinitely more wonderful to have Jesus as your king and to know that as long as he lives, which is forever, you are guaranteed the peace of God and the faithfulness of God. Make sure you're believing in Jesus Christ this morning. Amen.